Next speaker is Professor Olga Solomon. Olga Solomon is an applied linguist. It's hard to actually describe you in disciplinary terms because where are you? Ah, there you are. It's hard to describe you in disciplinary terms because you do such interdisciplinary stuff. She is a professor occupational science at the University of Southern California. She's done such fascinating work on the effects of autism on everyday life and various problems of the way in which meaning is communicated in various populations. So her title is Emic and Edic Perspectives in the Construction of Authoritative Knowledge on Autism.
Good morning. I'm very humbled to speak after John and Maureen, and I hope that I can keep your attention with this talk now. So the talk is called Emic and Edic Perspectives in the Construction of Authoritative Knowledge of Autism, and as Richard mentioned in his keynote this morning, often you have a title and then you realize you're going to actually do something different. So there is a little addition, Understanding Children's and Parents' Experiences of Healthcare. And the line drawing that hopefully you see on the slide is just the line drawing of a frame grab that is just the moment in a medical visit of a boy who is 8 years old with autism and his mother with their neurologist, with the boy's neurologist. And you'll see these slides today, and the reason we don't show video usually from the study that this drawing comes from is to protect confidentiality of the families, the physicians, and the children. My starting point are the questions asked by anthropologist Elizabeth Fine in a recent article in the Psychological Anthropology journal Ethos. How and why do certain kinds of societies produce certain kinds of people? How do particular forms of social organization interact with individual characteristics to produce patterns of experience, beliefs, and behavior? And we can think about John's talk just thinking about these questions. Anthropologists Raina Rapp and Faye Ginsberg remind us that disability is a profoundly relational category, always already created as a distinction from cultural ideas of normality shaped by social conditions that exclude full participation in society of those considered atypical. But what counts as an impairment in different sociocultural settings is highly variable. As Richard Grinker and Kai-Jung Cho have argued, although psychiatric diagnoses are social constructions that are situated in socio-historical and economic context, the constellations of symptoms that these diagnoses signify are experienced as real and disabling by the affected individuals and their families independently of what diagnostic categories or clinical terms are assigned to these symptoms. But they're also experienced in relationship to these diagnostic categories and clinical terms that become part of individuals' and families' narratives about the nature, the cause, and the subjectively imagined futures. So this talk is about where and how the emic and the edic perspectives meet on autism. I examined the tension between the particularities of individual and family's experiences of autism and the experience distant notions that frame these particularities as part of a larger generalized pattern. Furthermore, I consider ways in which the tension resides not only between the research arena and the personal or family experiences, but as a double vision, as anthropologist Cheryl Mattingly describes, that sees autism simultaneously as a biomedical condition and a lived experience, a way of being in the world. So I will draw from my current research to examine how the emic and the edic perspectives on autism are involved in one particular context, the interactional processes of healthcare provision for children diagnosed with ASD, specifically in child-mother-doctor interactions during medical visits. But first, let me quickly explain what emic and edic mean. Anthropologists and other social science researchers have long grappled with how to conceptualize and study the relation between the embodied human experience and the specialized biomedical systems of knowledge across cultures. Several dichotomies have emerged that to address this problem. Elliot Mishler, a psychiatrist and one of the founders of narrative psychology, made a distinction between the voice of the life world, referring to the patient's contextually grounded experiences, and the voice of medicine that reflects a technical interest and expresses a scientific attitude. The distinction made in medical anthropology is between the term disease, the term disease and the term illness signifies the duality of the biomedical etic and the experiential emic phenomena. Finally, there is the distinction made by Clifford Geertz between the experience near and the experience distant phenomena, and I'll just leave it at that for now. So I'm going to try and ask the question that Richard posed to us. What kinds of authority have structured and been structured by scientific representations of autism? And first, I'm going to try and address the first part of this question. The value of the emic and etic distinction lies in explicating how the dialogue between two very different existential and epistemic positions, biomedicine and social science on one hand, and the lived experience of people with ASD and their families on the other, has generated the system of authoritative knowledge and practices that is called autism research today. We can think back all the way to the psychogenic theory of autism or to the more recent history of research on regression, for many years believed to be a figment of parents' imagination, and now we know that between 25 and 30% of young children with ASD lose their developmental gains. Even more recently, the research community has discovered, through listening to parents who participated in the Interactive Autism Network's online survey on elopement in 2011, and then reading the Anderson et al. 2012 article on pediatrics, as well as through the work of the Interagency Autism Coordination Coordinating Committee, for which it was thanked by Kathleen Sebelius, former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, that a very large proportion of children with ASD have tendency to this very dangerous behavior, and that these tendencies remain mostly unaddressed by professionals and mostly understudied by researchers. I had a very humbling experience on my research project where the first paper that we published was on elopement and wandering, because that's what came out of the data first, the urgent concern of the families with this behavior and our design of our methodology that elicited the emic perspective of the families to really get to what is the most important to them. So now, for the second half of the question, what kinds of authority have been structured by scientific representations of autism? As philosopher Ian Hacking, whom Richard cited in his keynote this morning, explains, often conflicting discourses make up, through a process he calls looping, different kinds of people with autism, because descriptive and diagnostic categories become assimilated into individuals' and families' practices and descriptions of themselves. Some of these descriptions, Hacking suggests, create thicker and richer images of subjectivities and inner lives of people with autism than do other descriptions. These different descriptions can coexist and hybridize within the same family and even within the same parent's understanding of his or her child with autism. But if this were all we would be interested in, we could overlook the transformation of knowledge and expertise that people on the spectrum, their parents and extended family, and the professionals who serve them carry out in their everyday lives. And now to the data. The data on the interactional processes of healthcare provision for children diagnosed with ASD were collected as part of the Autism and Urban Context project that involved an interdisciplinary team of researchers and clinicians and was funded by NIMH. We followed 23 families with 25 children, ages 4 to 8 at the time of recruitment, all diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and the primary caregiver self-identified as African-American. We followed some of these families for 3.5 years. The number of people in the family cohort was 80. We also recruited 68 professionals, from medical doctors to psychologists to therapists to regional center coordinators, who served these families in some capacities and who agreed to participate in our study. The methodology was a tripart approach, which included urban ethnography, narrative and discourse and conversation analysis, and social networks analysis. And we collected the massive ethnographic data corpus that we're currently analyzing. So for today, for the healthcare encounters study, we looked at 16 healthcare encounters that we recorded, mostly video recorded, some of them are audio recorded, of 4 children with ASD, 4 mothers, 2 fathers who accompanied the children and their mothers, and 7 physicians. And we also analyzed 12 interviews with the children's mothers immediately after these visits, and 4 interviews with the physicians. So, okay. Let's look at the first few moments of these visits. As a sociocultural practice, greetings establish the condition for a particular kind of a culturally recognizable social encounter and function as an acknowledgement of the other person's presence, while also marking him and her as a distinct being worth recognizing. In other words, greetings quickly establish who is who to whom and also set the tone for medical visits. Problem presentation is an integral part of most healthcare encounters where reasons for seeking medical care are articulated. And it also is a site where the voice of medicine and the voice of the life world, or the emic, the etic, and perspective meet. But this meeting is not only identifying the healthcare needs of the child, but also about understanding autism and the child himself. So in this excerpt from our data, Simone, Alex's mother, says in the narrative interview, he, the doctor, did not engage with Alex. He engaged with me, but he didn't engage with Alex very much, so it's a biggie. If they engage with Alex, like Dr. Takeda took the time, which is really important to me, he took the time and actually, Alex, what's your name? And he's like, Alex. He took the time to interact with him. A lot of the times, doctors are like, what's the problem, you know, what's going on? It's too easy. So in an interview with Dr. Takeda, I'm not going to read the end of it, but basically she says it's very, very important to her that doctors do this. In an interview with the doctor himself, we hear his perspective. So this is what he said. It was a long interview. This is just a small part. He said, it's too easy to get frustrated and be dismissive of some of the difficult autistic children. I mean, because, you know, they're running around the office more. They may be more destructive. It's hard, very hard to do an exam. You don't know how far you're getting through, but they have the logic going on in their own brain. They're interpreting the world in a different way. They're speaking a different language. So it's the burden upon me to understand them as much as it is for them to understand our world. So it matters because the social construction of children's communicative and epistemic capabilities and their rights to participate in their healthcare visits are constructed in interactions just like that. In the first moments of the visit, how doctors interact with children is linked to parents' satisfaction with care and adherence to treatment. We know that parents place great value in the rapport between professionals and their child, insisting that the professional actually know their child before they can provide treatment recommendations. And whether and how doctors call children by name, engage them in social greetings, or select them as speakers when initiating problem presentation, subtly but powerfully constructs the children as certain kinds of interactants, either potentially able or a priori unable to respond, to participate, and to relate during the healthcare encounter. So in this very quick example of a greeting sequence, this is conversation analytic conventions, so just ignore all the strange signs here. So the doctor enters the room and the mother says, hi, Dr. Takeda. Alex, say hi. Alex is sitting on the exam table and hums, rocking back and forth, and mother says, say hi. The doctor looks at Alex and raises his hand in a greeting, and Alex says hi and looks away, but it's not good enough. So his mother says, Alex. The doctor looks at Alex and says, how are you? Alex looks in the direction of the camera, away from Dr. Takeda, and then mother says to Alex, eye contact. And she turns him by the chin so he faces the doctor. Then Alex finally looks at Dr. Takeda, who leans down and looks at Alex and says, how are you? He touches the top of Alex's head to align Alex's gaze and softly says, how are you? There is a long pause. And then the mother says, good? Say good? Alex says, good. And he touches Dr. Takeda's hand as if doing a high five, which is actually the greeting practice that they usually use. And mother says, yay. Doctor says, good job. Okay. And how are you doing? So we can see in this quick example, at the micro level, the step-by-step interactional work that the three participants carry out in their greeting sequence, which sets up a tone for the remaining visit. Alex is seen as a person who has a relationship with his doctor and who is seen and known by him. We can also see what his mother perceives as missing in Alex's behavior, face-to-face orientation, eye gaze, and speech. In another greeting sequence, Alex's neurologist doesn't say hello and just goes straight to the computer. And he asks then a problem presentation implicative question that has the features of a greeting. So how is everybody? Some questions, when asked after a greeting that establish who is who to whom, usually elicit a report of developmental gains or setbacks, but not in this visit. Simone then tells a story of something that happened that morning. He has become very affectionate. And then she tells a story about how Alex actually wiped the tears of his classmate's face when the classmate was crying because his aide left and he was upset and sad. So Simone said he had actually acknowledged the little boy. Other than that, he won't acknowledge the kids are there. But he is noticing emotion. He wants to hold people's hand. The story constructs Alex as a certain kind of person, responsive and empathic, while at the same time it grapples with the notion that Alex does not usually interact with the other children. That the story is told in response to, so how is everybody, in the first seconds of the visit, positions Alex within the visit in a way that, even in the absence of the doctors engaging with Alex directly in a greeting, is designed to set a certain tone. So how does this fine-grained interactional analysis of these tiny little moments in the data help shape us understand authoritative knowledge in autism? What do these brief data sequences tell us about the dialogue between the amicant and attic perspectives? What can we tell about the subtle power of the doctor's authority to render a child with autism and someone who is or is not able to participate in the greeting because he doesn't understand, doesn't care, cannot speak? What can we tell about the mother's authority, not only to insist in an interview with the researchers and even more importantly, to orchestrate interactions during healthcare visits where the doctors can see that her son is communicating, relating, has empathy? And why do we care? We care because studies on healthcare experiences and needs of children with ASD and their families have traditionally large-scale survey methodology, making little connection between population-level healthcare needs of children with ASD and the interactional patterns that may contribute to them. There is a growing interest in understanding the impact of socio-communicative and sensory impairments associated with ASD on the provision of healthcare. And we also know that compared to other pediatric populations, children with ASD have increased unmet healthcare needs in spite of increased healthcare utilization. They have more outpatient visits, are more hospitalized, nearly 9 times more likely to use psychotherapeutic medication and twice as likely to use gastrointestinal agents than children without ASD. They experience greater unmet healthcare needs and face significant disparities in receiving comprehensive, coordinated healthcare services and specialty care compared to children without ASD. We can look for ways to improve this picture through better understanding children's and parents' experiences of healthcare and the interaction of the EMIC and the ethics perspective during healthcare visits. These are references. Thank you.